This is the weekly show all about weather. This is Weather Brains episode number 359 for December the 10th. 2012. We're getting awfully close to Christmas. Thanks a lot for joining us. My name is James Spann. We have a very, very good show lined up tonight because a lot of smart people are here, including the internationally beloved meteorologist, Brian Peters. Brian, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing fabulous. Always love it when I give a forecast on Sunday night and Friday or a Monday morning. I only miss the tornado by 5 hours.
There you go. What's 5 hours between friends?
5 hours, you know.
So what are you getting used to being working late and doing the weekend thing? I mean, for those that don't know, Brian is also in addition to being a retired National Weather Service WCM, he is also a television meteorologist that happens to work at the same place where I work. I do the weeknights. He does the weekends, staying up late, no sleep. How you liking it?
Oh, it's been nice. I was a little unsure last night about coming home after the 10 o'clock news. But I decided the weather wouldn't get into our area before Charles would get there. So,
and yeah, those are the rough decisions when you're working the late shift and you've got a marginal overnight severe weather event. The morning shift person doesn't get in until like, you know, 3, and you're set to go home at 11, and you have to debate in your mind, okay, can I go home and can this place be unmanned for 4 hours, or do I stay and sit and do nothing because you know nothing's going to happen? It's hard.
Well, what happened was, and I know this is too much information, I came home and I kept on my tie and my shirt. I just took off my pants and watched the radar for about an hour and a half.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a show title. The greatest show titles are just established in the first 5 minutes of this show. I took off my pants. That is going to be the title of this show.
Like I said, too much information right there, Rob. It's so much easier to put your pants on than it is to put on a tie. So I figured if I had to go back, I'd have the shirt and the tie on. See? Slipping into the pants.
I wish I could just be in a house of maybe some senior adults that are, you know, turning on the Weather Channel to watch for the forecast and check the radar. And they turn it on to hear Brian Peters say, I was ready to go, but I went home and took off my pants.
Never a dull moment.
We got producer JP in Starkville, Mississippi. What are you typing over there, man? You're typing something up.
I just saw a YouTube video of the worst free throw ever attempted. Did you see this? That went viral on YouTube today. This is horrible. No. It was a Western Carolina versus Appalachian State game. It's got almost 5 million views, and it is bad.
We'll have to put a link up on the show notes.
I wanted to throw some little funny up that I saw, but it's pretty bad there. But
plug the live deal, because JP is our chat room monitor. Yes, if you want to get on and interact with us,
absolutely. Going to get to that shuffling Safari tabs here. Check us out at live.bigbrainsmedia.com. Come hang out with us in chat and let us know how we're doing. But I'll throw a link to this video up. You guys got to see this. It's bad.
I love bad videos, and JP is the guy that puts this show together. He stays up all night Monday night and has to edit the audio version, which is how most folks listen to this. So we're glad JP is here. And Nate Johnson's chair is empty, which is a little scary. All right, that's his shot right there. If you're watching this, and we can see that nice little portrait in the background. We can see his I can see his AMS CBM certificate. I can see his NWA seal. I can see it looks like an old AMS seal. Whoa!
Yeah, there he is.
Oh, there he is. Oh yeah. See, he doesn't know we've got him punched up right now. This is great. Oh, this is good. He can't hear a word we're saying. Anybody want to say anything ugly about Nate before he plugs in? Yeah, there you go. So how was class tonight, Professor?
It was good. We finished up. Tonight was the final exam period. We looked at essentially resume tapes for everybody. And I think these guys are going to have a good career, good careers in television.
Okay, cool. So what's happening in Raleigh, North Carolina?
It's unseasonably warm. It should not be this warm in December in North Carolina, period. The 70s today, 70s yesterday. I mean, it feels like late September outside. It's just weird.
Well, you're just in the wrong place.
Well, I could be like those folks in Fairbanks. That would be nice. The 40 below. I mean,
it feels like it's 40 below where I am, even though it's 40 above because it's been so mild lately. But let's bring in our guests. And I'm really excited. I think this is going to be a great show. I'll let Bill Murray. Bill Murray, you've been AWOL lately. Where have you been? Gambling, a gambling junket? Or what have you been doing over the last couple of weeks?
I wish. You know, I've actually had to do real work for the last 2 months. It's been horrible. So I need a note, James, to my regular job saying that I'm excused on Monday nights. Could you work on that?
I'm writing it right now.
Yeah, James, we've got a special guest panelist with us tonight. He's a WeatherBrains alum. He's been with us several times. He's vice president at Midland Radio and is known in most circles as Mr. Weather Radio. And he's the president-elect, I guess actually the acting president of the National Weather Association. He happened to be in Birmingham today because he came over for a special event. Bruce Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's good to be on WeatherBrains. It's been a while, and now I see you guys have, in the video realm. So last time I was on, it was all audio only.
Yeah, see, when you were here before, it was audio. Now it's this high-tech production that you can see here.
We all got Apple headsets on, so...
Let me play. Kevin is not here. He sent some audio. I've not listened to it. I have no idea where he is, what he's doing. I've not sampled this, but this is audio just sent in by Kevin Seller.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Dad's out.
I had a feeling it was going to. You called it. That was Kevin's son Matthew announcing that his dad is out. So Bill, go back to regular programming. I'm sorry.
You know, James, Bruce always seems to show up when there's bad weather. He landed today about 4 hours after the tornado. So whenever you get Bruce's itinerary, you need to go ahead and plug your weather radios in. Bruce, you landed in some bad conditions today, huh?
Well, I started out this morning. I was in Daytona Beach, Florida, actually, at a birthday party yesterday at my sister's house, and woke up and watched the sunrise over the Atlantic Ocean, and had strong southwest low-level cloudiness, and looked up and I saw that. I said, it's going to be a warm day in Florida, and I listened to the radio on the way into the airport, said it's going to be a record high possibly. I don't know what they topped out at, but it was 84 is the record high in Orlando. But we had dense fog this morning in Orlando, and I took off, and it was neat to fly out, drove and flew out in heavy fog, then landed in heavy rain in Birmingham. So a great weather day. And then got in a car and drove all the way to Starkville. And the rain stopped right when I got to the Mississippi line. When I crossed over out of Alabama, the rain just stopped. I guess I just finally got to the back line, back edge. And it was interesting. I haven't been to Tuscaloosa since the big tornado. And it was pouring down rain, and I was driving through Tuscaloosa. And there's McFarland Boulevard is the way they steer you off of 59. So, boy, I drove up and I saw them all, and I looked up towards the trees and got to see the actual damage path, what it looks like now, and really thought about my career in weather and thought about Dr. Charles Wax over at Mississippi State University that was retiring today. And thought about the disciples of Dr. Charles Wax, because there's a lot of people out there, including yourself, James, that learned a lot through Mississippi State and have a lot to talk about. You know, he was a pioneer in distance learning and bringing Mark Binkley to Mississippi State and starting that distance learning for broadcast meteorologists. And they say that about 2/3 of all meteorologists on television in America have been touched by that program at some part. So that's what I did today. I drove over to Starkville to go to a retirement party for Dr. Charles Wax, and that's why I'm in town here in Birmingham. And I drove back from Starkville to have dinner with Bill Murray and his wife, Sally, and they took me out for some really good barbecue tonight. and asked me to be on Weather Brains, too.
It just worked out perfectly. So we're glad you're here. We want to hear more about this retirement party later.
Okay, you bet.
So we're glad you're with us tonight. And our guest Weather Brain tonight is the Science Operations Officer at the National Weather Service in Birmingham. We've moved Kevin around about four or five times to get him to this night, and he's given up Monday Night Football so he could be with us because he's got an important message. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
You know, Kevin, it's interesting to me, you know, when we talk about statistics and, you know, the warning process, and today, obviously, we've had severe weather here, and, you know, we talk often about the false alarm problem. And when you took this job at Birmingham, you know, you said, you know, hey, let's do something about this. So talk for a second about, you know, leading up to this year, you know, what the main measuring sticks have been, at least in the Birmingham CWA, in terms of false alarm, probability of detection, lead time, those things.
Yeah, Bill, I mean, I think we were pretty much about average, Weather Service average, maybe, coming in. But, you know, I pretty much chewed my teeth right here. I came in 2007 as a journey forecaster and then moved to a lead in 2009. So I've pretty much been here, I guess, during the modern era, I guess the polygon era, if you want to call it that. And so I think we've been about average, but I just, you know, I've always had in the back of my mind that our folks here in Birmingham are just way too talented to be just average. I thought we were always above average, and I didn't want to settle. So when I got the opportunity, I guess the old Sue Kevin Pence, you know, great Sue, hard to walk in his shoes, that's for sure. So I thought when he retired, I would just try to step in and try to fill some of that. And, you know, my number one and really only priority has been to take a look at those stats and see if we can just do a little bit better. You know, we have the technology the way it is, and let's just do a little bit better than what we've been doing. But I've been really impressed with our staff, and, you know, we've kind of come together and worked on some things, and that hopefully I'll share tonight. And, you know, I really think we pulled some things together that I've really been happy with so far.
So now some of those numbers you're talking about, Kevin, and I want you to give a little primer for the audience. You know, when we talk about false alarm rate, what does that really mean in terms of statistics?
Well, in the polygon era, it's just one polygon, one tornado, if you will, if you want to talk about tornadoes. So every time we would put one out, you know, and again, the hard part about weather warnings, especially the tornado warnings, is that, you know, if it could be an 8-day forecast or it could be a 14-minute forecast. At some point, it's going to be a forecast of the weather. So we've tried to, you know, work on the fact that we're forecasting tornadoes and to kind of treat it that way. Inevitably, I guess when you forecast, you're going to have busts, especially about, you know, something that's as minute as tornadoes on the mesoscale like that. So that's really where the false alarm comes from, because, you know, out of rotating storms, only about in the southeast, probably only about 90% don't put down tornadoes, and only about 10% do. So you really are starting with a 90% false alarm rate. That's if you warn on every single storm that's rotating. So I just think there's some things that we as a group, as a whole, probably should have improved on and worked on through the years. And I think that, you know, we are trained this way. We've all learned it in school, what to look for as the meteorology goes. And I think what happened was you get kind of caught up with the Doppler radar and you kind of look scan to scan. I just think there were some things that we were kind of missing there and put some pieces back together that everybody knows it's just sort of forgotten. And to be honest with you, it's about the hardest thing we do, too. But it's also the most important thing we do.
So a false alarm occurs when you issue a warning and a tornado does not occur in that polygon. Is that a simple definition?
That is the National Weather Service definition, yes.
And that happens on average about 8 out of 10 times, and that's sort of where the Birmingham office was, right?
Exactly. That's about, on average as a whole, especially here in the southeast, I've compared our stats to the surrounding offices, and we're all in the upper 70s to middle 80s, everybody.
Yeah, so that means that 4 out of 5 times that you put out a tornado warning, a tornado actually doesn't occur. And, of course,
that's
there's
right.
been a lot of discussion about whether that number is too high or not.
Well, in my opinion, it's too high. I mean, I want it to be, you know, I want it to be zero. So that's for sure. And I think, you know, while it may seem impossible with today's technology, I think, you know, we can certainly do better than 80%, in my opinion.
to a very related statistic is probability of detection, and that means how many times you actually catch a tornado. So, you know, if there are 100 tornadoes, you want to catch 100 of them, ideally. That would be a probability of detection of one, right? 100%.
That's correct, yeah.
And so right now, where does, in the 2007 to 2011 era, you know, where did the nation stand? Where did Birmingham stand in terms of that?
It was a little better than 80%. So it was about, it was pretty close to the false alarm. I think the false alarm was about 78 and the probability detection was about 82, something like that. So they were pretty much on par with each other. And that again, is consistent with everybody. So
now the general theory is that if you improve your false alarm rate, you get a corresponding decrease in the probability of detection, right?
That's correct. I mean, if you decrease in the number of warnings that you're putting out, you're going to decrease the false alarm just based on a statistical average. But you're also going to, you know, the hypothesis is that you're also going to decrease your POD and your lead time as well. So everything would have to suffer. The things you don't want to have suffer, which is the POD and the lead time, is going to suffer if you try to improve on false alarm.
And you said something a minute ago that I think is very important, Kevin, because you said that, you know, that even a 14-minute tornado warning, a 14-minute lead time is a forecast. You know, we don't think of it that way, but if you don't get that warning out before the tornado touches down, you know, your lead time is zero, or, you know, and then, you know, potentially people die. Your goal is to give them as much lead time as possible. And, you know, now that the national benchmark is around 14 minutes, how's Birmingham and the rest of the country been doing?
The rest of the country is about where the 14 is. Birmingham's a little better than that. For supercells, I think we're about 27 minutes of lead time, which, you know, a lot of that's thanks to April of 2011. But even with QLCSs, we're about 12 minutes. So we average out at about 17, almost 18 minutes. So I'm pretty happy with the lead time. I can't do much better than that, especially with some of the storms we have around here.
But like I said, a lot of folks were critical of the fact that the false alarm rate was too high, and you agree with that. And so you set out to do some things. What have you done? What has your research led you to do with the forecasters here in Birmingham?
Well, we started from scratch, really. We started all the way back at the beginning, and I've looked at every single warning we've put out since we went to the polygon era, which is October 1st, 2007. And it's a lot of warnings. It was about 850 warnings since in 5 years. And compare that to 260 tornadoes. So that's where you get about the 80% false alarm rate. But I went back and I just looked at every single tornado warning, every single missed tornado, and really I just categorized everything at the beginning into, was it a supercell, QLCS, squall line, tropical, tornado, and we just kind of went from there to see where we needed to improve. The hypothesis again is that QLCSs are probably going to be the problem, and that turned out to be true. Wasn't as big of a problem as I thought. I was thinking it was probably going to be double what the supercell was. Say the false alarm was going to be double what the supercell, but it was only about 13 points higher. But that obviously that's where we needed to improve. I think the false alarm for supercell is about 67, and the false alarm for QLCS is about 82. So there was that improvement there that we definitely needed to do. So after we categorized it, we started looking at some other things, how we, were staffing events. I kind of looked at everybody's individual staffs, and I thought we were making some mistakes in the staffing of severe weather events that we shouldn't be making. In other words, when we had slight risk, you know, the marginal days, we were putting some of our rookies on the radar, and the marginal slight risk CTEX kind of days are going to lead to marginal warnings. And that's what was happening. Those, you know, when you come in as a young person, and I still identify that in a lot of ways, is that you want to catch everything. You don't want to miss anything. You don't want that hanging on your head. So I found that a lot of our younger folks had that mindset that, hey, I don't want to miss anything. So we were just, you know, we were putting out a lot of warnings, and the slight risk CTEX kind of days were always the squall line tornado kind of days. And it turns out that they were issuing a majority of them. And I just think that was a big mistake. We need to, you know, they were getting a lot of radar experience, but they weren't getting a lot of radar expertise. And I think that we were making a big mistake there.
So So that's a critical component of what you're talking about, is that you put your best people on your more challenging events, like April 27th, probably, as Jim Stefkovich told me the following morning. He said, Bill, this was, you know, warning yesterday was shooting fish in a barrel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you saw the storms on radar. You knew they were producing tornadoes. You're talking about these marginal events like this morning here in Birmingham.
Exactly. And I saw from 2007 to 2011, that's exactly what was happening. We were saying, oh, well, this is just a slight risk day. This is just a C-Tex day here. You don't have a lot of radar experience. Sit down and get some seed time. That just doesn't work that way. But on the other hand, that's a good point about shooting fish in the barrel, but you know also that you don't want to make a mistake on those days either. If you make a mistake, it's going to be big. So what was happening, probably rightly so, is we were also putting the veterans, the experienced people in the seats on April 15th, April 27th. So to make sure that, you know, it was shooting fish in a barrel, so to speak.
Now, Kevin, talk for a second, because I've had the privilege of sitting at the Weather Service in Clear and watching you issue real live warnings and real events. And talk about what goes into that process and what you have to do as a forecaster to actually get that warning out to the world.
Yeah, really, it's old school kind of software. Basically, the software still kind of old school still works. You know, so it kind of draws a little polygon on there for you. Engineer is a polygon. The science engineer guy is not meteorologist. Put all the software together, and really, you can just manipulate that. Put the little points, click on and off counties that you want. And I think that's, you know, where we've been working on some things as well, making sure the right counties are in there, because we still know everything's, you know, the sirens and whatnot. The weather radios still go off countywide, so some of those things have come up as well, but. Yeah, it's really just a simple process. You know, basically a rectangle comes up. I can show you some examples here in a second if you want to see them. But basically a rectangle comes up, and you just manipulate that and send it on its way.
So this polygon then has a width and a length and a time, right? Are those the three dimensions that you're working in?
Exactly right. And that's, you know, something that the research has carried us in, is having those dimensions of space and dimension of time is sometimes a little bit tricky, because you have to worry about, you know, the storm running out of the box, out of your polygon, and you have to worry about the time running out as well. So adds complexity to the warnings, especially if you're trying to manage, you know, half a dozen or more. So it becomes quite a challenge. We really kind of work in partnerships to make, and our partner kind of tries to keep track of that stuff for us. So
talk for a minute about some of the best demonstrated practices that you came up with and started, you know, bringing your team's attention to, Kevin, that make one polygon better than another.
Yeah, well, a big one is making sure that the counties are what you want them to be. In other words, if you have too many counties, and if, you know, say on the front side or the back side of the polygon, even if a little 5-square-mile area is in there, all the sirens are going to go off and all the weather radios. And I think that was what was driving a lot of the warning fatigue, was that, you know, people felt like they were in a warning a lot more than they were. You know, folks on an average can't get the polygon warnings, and probably don't get them. So all they hear is weather radio, see, you know, James on TV, or hear the sirens. One of the three options is probably how they, you know, most people get their weather information. So if you click on even a little small piece of the county, all of it goes off. And I thought we could really improve by making sure the correct counties, the counties we want to have in the warning, are in there, and simple clicking off those counties, even if they may get some marginal, say, hail or straight line wind damage, if the tornado is not going to affect that county, let's just make sure that county is not going to be in the warning.
And I really, hey, Kevin, how do you mitigate that? Did you make some changes in the software that draws the polygons, or how did you do the improvement? Because there is a noticeable improvement now. We're not getting those little, you know, 3-square-mile slivers of counties anymore.
Well, for the most part, the software, it's called warning generation software, is kind of fixed. The engineers fixed it. It's in hard coded into our systems, but there is one little thing you can do, and that is if you access accidentally, say, get one square mile, two square miles, you can actually choose that, and it will click off for you. So we upped that, I think, to a 5%. So a 5% or less of the county is in that polygon, it will automatically take it out of the warning. So that was big. That was one big thing. And really the second one was that what we try to do is we try to make the polygons now longer in time. So we make them 45, 60 minutes. But we don't go as far out in space. So we go shorter in space and longer in time. And what that allows us to do is takes the time dimension out of it. So you're never going to run out of time with these polygons. We can always cancel them early. But what it does do is the counties way downstream, we leave those out of the warning for the time being. And that will give us, you know, 15, 20 minutes to make a decision about those counties downstream. So in other words, we're not putting four counties in the polygon. We're just kind of doing one county at a time and just seeing how it goes as it crosses, say, the said county. Now, it doesn't always work out that way, just depending on the shape, but and this is sort of something new. So we're, you know, we really tried it big time on March 2nd. If you notice, on March 2nd, when I was warning, I just kind of did Chilton, then Coosa, then Tallapoosa. I was just kind of doing one at a time to see how those warnings or how the storm structure would change. And maybe we didn't need to do all of them, so we weren't trying to do too many at once, if that makes sense.
So does this add any stress or workload to the forecaster, Kevin? Is that one of the things you have to measure this against?
Yeah, and it'll be really dependent on how we go forward. Like I said, it's sort of new, so it's something we're kind of testing in real time a little bit. But it, like I said, it does take away that time dimension, so you never have to worry about running out of time. They weren't extending the time long enough. So when the time's too short, you'll have to rewarn for that same county again because it hadn't got across into the next county. So you'd have to rewarn for like that 5 minute extra time if it was at the end of the county. So all the radios again would go off for that county once again. And we want to avoid that. But yeah, the really big thing about it is you can't wait too long. You have to make that warning decision downstream a little bit earlier if you want to get appreciable lead time, especially say on the western side of that new polygon.
Because I guess your point is, Kevin, that you're still warning back the sirens and the weather radios are going off upstream where the storm is already well downstream.
Exactly right.
Nate, you were going to ask
that? Hey, let's just tackle this real quick since Bruce is here. I mean, this is like one of the 800-pound gorillas in the room. The sirens in most counties, in most municipalities, they're still county-based, and weather radio is still county-based. So, Bruce, where do we stand on getting weather radios polygon-based?
Well, I think that it still comes back down to the Weather Service, James, being able to blast out the latitude and longitude in the warning that can be detected by a smart weather radio, probably with an embedded GPS chip. The price has come down on GPS chipsets, and that's what we've been pushing for. But in the meantime, we'd like to see the Weather Service offices utilize the first digit on the SAME code and allow them to break the counties down into thirds or quarters or ninths even. Probably ninths is a bit much, but you could quarter up a county pretty well, or give out those first digits on the SAME code to specific locations, like the University of Alabama could be a digit on the SAME code for that county. And everybody that had a weather radio on campus could all be warned at once. So that's where we are, really, with getting more geospecific with a NOAA weather radio.
All right. So Kevin, Bruce is throwing it back to you guys. What do you guys say?
Yeah, I mean, we've thrown that up over the last year as far as using that first digit. You know, essentially with, you know, digits 1 or 0 through 9 or 1 through 9, I think you could divide the county up by nines or something like that. But, you know, what I'd really like to see is us just take the bull by the horns and just do the whole thing. Let's go ahead and get weather radio upgraded. I mean, it's been around for a long time. So, money's going to be tight. We know that. But I'd really like to see us just do the upgrade. But we've also, I'll just throw this out there, we've looked at some experimental stuff with some sidebands as well, and putting out some GPS coordinates on some sidebands and side lobes of the broadcast signal. So there are some tests underway, believe it or not, for some of this stuff, and I think we'll get there probably sooner than later.
I mean, the carving counties up into ninths was discussed at the county-based warning workshop in 2006. That was discussed there, and it was one of those things that we decided would be a good thing. But how you do it. You know, do you carve up, let's see, if you've got a nice square county, like a lot of them in Kansas and Texas and the Plains, you can do that really easily. But if you've got counties like Tom Green County, for example, in Texas, looks kind of like the state of Oklahoma. So how do you carve that one up? Do you give the panhandle one code? And, you know, do you do the ninths or do you do quarters or do you do, you know, a hybrid, or do you do some sort of something where one town in the county gets a code on its own, and it becomes a configuration. I don't want to say nightmare, but it's certainly a challenge to have to do that, because you have to take every county, you know, and then it's a great thing for the local offices to do, because they're going to know their area better than anybody else. But at the same time, how do you collect all that information and then get it out to the people that issue the warnings, that make the weather radios, that create the apps, that sort of thing? That's where I think this sideband thing may have some promise, because you're leaving the main frequency alone, so we're not antiquating all of the weather radios that are already in the field that people depend on, but they can go and buy a new one that will take advantage of this extra information while leaving this primary thing, you know, separate. I think that, you know, short of doing a sort of a digital TV cutoff like we did in the TV industry a few years ago, I kind of like the sideband thing. I hope there's it's first I've heard of it, but I love the idea.
Bruce, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, we've been talking about that and being able to maybe even send out a digital burst with even an image that could have a display on a weather radio and take a color image, maybe even send out a snapshot of a radar and the polygon to the receiver. And I think that would be the ultimate use of a home weather radio, would be actually get a picture of the radar with a polygon, you know, sent to your home. And with the price of displays coming down, you know, you got to keep the cost, Nate, down under $100, you know, for a weather radio. We got to keep the cost down. Right now, I think this week, you can buy a really good SAME radio for $25 at Walgreens. They're on special this week. High quality.
But then,
it's, you know, we've got the price down now where everyone can afford it, but now everybody wants a next paradigm shift. And I agree, we need that next paradigm shift. We need to be working on it. And there's a gentleman in Washington at Silver Spring at the Weather Service that's working on several things right now, and we stay in contact with him. Matt Bunkers, I believe, up in he's in South Dakota, has actually done some work breaking up some counties, and I believe it's South Dakota. It's one of the Dakotas. And right now in Pima County, to answer your first question, Nate, Pima County, Arizona, is a huge county, probably as big as, you know, one of the smaller states in the Northeast. What they did is they used the first digit and they broke it into thirds, and then they used the fourth digit just for Tucson, Pima County. Mm-hmm. So they've got East, West, and Central. And I believe the central one is the actual Tucson metropolitan area. But they just took it and broke the county into thirds. And you're right. I mean, we've got over 3,000 counties in America, 254 in the state of Texas. So how do you do this and still keep some relevance to the forecaster? It's got to be automated. It has to be automated. It can't be something that someone has to sit and think about a lot when they're trying to issue tornado warnings, because, you know, seconds count.
Or when they're programming the radio. And I think that's, you know, I love the fact that the price of these things is down to, you know, $25-$30 for a good quality radio. The problem is, and my suit guy at the, I won't name the establishment, but it's one of those retail jobs where the guy advertises on TV and says, you're going to like the way you look. You know, they always say the most expensive suit, or, you know, insert blank here, is the one you don't wear. And that, I think, is the challenge, is getting it so that people that have weather radios, get them programmed, keep them plugged in, keep them up to date. And I know there are too many of them that they buy them, they run for once, they get them programmed, and they get one battery life out of it, and then it's done. And yeah, it may have been $25 up front, but if it's collecting dust in a closet, it's not doing anybody any good.
Well, first of all, the batteries, Nate, are for battery backup when the power fails. They all should be plugged in. All desktop weather radios, the batteries are actually backup power. So they should be plugged into the wall, AC current. And then when you have a power failure like we did during Sandy, where it lasts multiple days, most weather radios last 2 or 3 days on just normal, you know, alkaline batteries, maybe 4 or 5 on lithium. But, you know, we're all meteorologists on this program, and we all have apps, and we all have high-tech stuff, and we generally, you know, we know what the weather's doing a lot more. But what a weather radio really does for someone, say, living in Kansas, which I do, I live in Kansas, is it lets me know that my family's going to be warned when I'm not there. And, you know, my wife depends on weather radio. We have one on every level of our home. We also have a tornado safe room in our basement. So not only do we have a basement, we have a concrete safe room in our basement. And that's from living in Texas and not being able to have a basement in Texas and getting up to Kansas and seeing the basements and then putting in a safe room. Bill Murray's actually been in my safe room.
Yeah.
You can put my whole neighborhood in that thing, I think. But it came with the house. It was already built when I bought it. So, but to answer the question again, it's just one level of protection, Nate. And the newest weather radios on the market allow you to deselect what you do not want to be audibly alerted for. And that takes out, you know, the amber alerts and the watches or the flood warnings if that's not what you want. And you can tailor a weather radio, a $25 weather radio now can be tailored down so tight. If only you want to be warned for a tornado warning, you can make it only audibly alert for a tornado warning, and a nuclear and radiological event cannot be taken out. Those are the two things that can't be taken out. So it would take a while, you know, for someone to read the manual and understand how to do all of that. But it gives people options. And, you know, but on the flip side of this, Nate, right after a tornado event, we go out and program weather radios like we did in Birmingham. Most of the people wanted the county to their west, maybe the county to their south, southeast. Or, you know, they want multiple counties. We can't talk them into just putting one county in it. So it's, you know, if someone's living in Chattanooga after they were hit by several tornadoes in Huntsville and Birmingham, you'll find that the people who are very afraid of the weather, they don't just want their county. They want the county west, the county south. They want multiple counties. And we plead with them and say, don't do that. You're going to get overwarned, and you're going to eventually, you know, tune it out. But it's a perception thing. And but, you know, when people are scared of the weather, as they are in Alabama and many of the southern states after what we've seen, they actually count on them. People, it's a peace of mind, you know, for $25. I hope we get to that in the next 3 years where we have a GPS-enabled weather radio. I think we will, but we've been waiting for a long time for this.
Are we ever going to get to a point where a weather radio is as simple and ubiquitous, two different questions there, okay, as a – I know that Al Gore had mentioned that they ought to be like smoke detectors, that every house ought to have one, and it ought to be – and it ought to be as straightforward as just hooking up a smoke detector. It's there. It's part of the house. It's something, quite frankly, most of us take for granted, but it's there. Are we ever going to get to that point? Is that just a cost thing? You know, the legal code issues aside, is that the kind of thing that we should be shooting for as an enterprise?
Well, you know, there are communities in America where every single home has an old weather radio if they want it for free. Kevin, you were talking about Clanton, Alabama, correct?
Yeah, that's right. We just, I guess they got a FEMA grant, and with that money, they bought 4,000, and they gave one to every household and every business. And it was good because I believe, you know, Bruce and Midland, you know, they got the bid, so they pre-programmed every one of them, so you didn't have to sit there and do all 4,000. And that's, I guess that's something that you guys can easily do there at Midland. But, you know, they already came pre-programmed for Chilton County. It's already done. And that brings up a good point about just changing those FIP codes. Even if you broke it into ninth, we've given away and sold so many in this state, and getting people to reprogram those, that would be a heck of an educational outreach there. That's for sure.
Now, Kevin, we obviously understand that this is part of this false alarm area concept because our, you know, our legacy system's still worn on a county level. I want to get into for a few minutes because James, you know, recognized that you guys are doing, you know, a noticeable difference in your warning process this year. And so I think a lot of that has to do with the science of polygonology, not just the art, not just the practice. But for the weather weenies that are watching tonight, talk about the three areas or four areas that you identified science as being a factor in deciding when to pull those triggers.
Well, really, we broke it down and we looked at, you know, SPC's page, the mesoanalysis page, which is just derived from the old RUC and the RAP model now, I believe. But we looked at about 39 parameters, and we looked at 6 hours leading up to the first warning all the way through 6 hours past the first warning. So we had some time continuity there, and it ended up being about 19,000 data points. And I had some summer students, ambitious undergraduates, and they certainly took it upon themselves to mine through that data. And a couple things fell out of it that I was really impressed with and really taken aback with some of the things as well. So, for instance, like surface-based cape. I mean, that seems to be everybody's go-to product is surface-based cape. You can't go to SPC's mesoanalysis page without looking at that SB cape. And it turns out for our tornadoes here in the state that SB cape really didn't matter all that much. As long as you had some, you were usually good to go. And the more you had, it didn't really make a difference in the stronger tornadoes or anything. Now, April 27th was an anomaly. We had 2,500 cape that day. But, you know, on April 15th, the forgotten outbreak, we had 31 tornadoes in our CWA, more than we had on April 27th. And the cape that day was only 600 to 700. So what we found is once you get over about 300 joules per kilogram, you really are good to go, and that includes all ranges of tornadoes, from F0 all the way really to F2 and F3. So I really was surprised because, you know, the thought process is, well, the more cape, the better, the more cape, the better. And that really didn't really seem to come true. So that's something we can eliminate right away. And, you know, once we realize we're into the 400 and 500 joules per kilogram range, we're good to go. Don't worry about it anymore. Shouldn't be a problem. Then we started looking at other parameters that we all know about, the low-level helicity or low-level wind shear. And it turns out that, you know, around 30 knots, 35 knots is about our good cutoff. That's about what we had today. We had 30 to 35, so we're right there at that cutoff space. And that's why I felt good about issuing the watch and extending the watch further east with time, as we did today, because we were sitting at about 30, 35 knots. Now, if you go under that, under the 30, if you get down to 25, 20, we've even had cases where we've had watches out and warnings out where we had 15 knots of 0 to 1 kilometer bulk shear. And we've never had a tornado with 15 knots of bulk shear, but we've had warnings. And this is where we can really make up some of our points, say the false alarm points. If we're at 15, 20, we've only had about 1 to 2 tornadoes. We don't need to be putting warnings out on those days. And so there's some things, some telltale things that we can learn in the forecast and the nowcast mode. LCL.
Hey, Kevin, talk about LCL heights, if you don't mind. Yeah, but while we're pegging the geek meter, let's talk about LCL heights.
LCL is one of my favorite ones because that really showed a lot of promise as far as a cutoff. Believe it or not, if we have 1,000 meters, which, you know, about 3,000 feet or higher, 3,500 feet or higher cloud bases, historically here since 2005, we've only had about 2 tornadoes. And there are a lot of days. I'm sorry. Let me make that a little bit more clear. 1,200 meters. We've had about 2 to 5. I'd have to look right at the stats, but the nice smooth cutoff there was about 800 meters, 700 to 800. Once you get below that, it really spikes big time, and it kind of goes up exponentially. But if you come in on a day that we're in the quadruple digits, 1,000, 1,100, 1,200. You can pretty much forget it. You can write off that day, at least historically. Now, you know, you always have those spinning couplets is always going to make you sweat. But historically speaking, we haven't had a lot of tornadoes on days like that. Now, we've had a lot of warnings on days like that, but we haven't had a lot of tornadoes. And I thought that was the key thing there as far as making some improvement. So
really, and for those people that are operational guys, Kevin is giving you gems. I mean, these are like nuggets of truth that are applicable and will help. I mean, a lot of times, you know, we throw out stuff on the show that it's not that useful for us, but this really is good stuff. And I've always thought those LCL heights were important. But what you've done through mining, through all that data, Kevin, is, you know, given us this empirical evidence that it is true. This is a big deal.
Yes, it is. And a lot of times you hear it as far as Midwest tornadoes are concerned, but some of that does apply here. Some of it applies to squall line tornadoes. We didn't ever think that squall lines, LCL was all that important. Turns out it is. And we've had a lot of warnings on squall line days when the LCL is too high. And I think, you know, getting a number in people's head. Now, you can't look at it by itself. We know that. You have to look at it in context with everything else. But certainly it seemed to be a nice cutoff and something that was pretty robust as far as whether you're going to have a big tornado day or not. So it leads to a lot of questions. James, so think about this. If we had a setup just like April 27th with all the parameters and the LCL height that day was about 600, what if we doubled it to 1,200? You know, what would happen on the day like that? So, you know, it leads to us trying to make some assumptions about what kind of day we'd have if the, you know, the LCLs were double a big outbreak day or something.
And while we're talking weather weenie stuff, Kevin, if you could pick one composite index, if you could just look at one, okay, just one, and you know the big ones, which one would you pick and why?
That's a good question. You know, it's tough for me because I know that those were developed over Midwest tornadoes, and I just don't think a lot of those apply to the Southeast tornadoes. Our LCLs here are always typically lower than the Midwest, and but really, you know what my favorite is? Probably the supercell index. I really like that one. It's kind of old school, but it kind of gives you that clue that at least you're going to have rotating storms. Now, the significant tornado parameter, that's it's out there, but again, it was developed using Midwest tornadoes and Midwest supercells, and I think some of that could apply to us. And sort of what we've done is we've taken it and we've applied it to the data we have, and I think we have sort of a Southeast significant tornado index of our own here. So it kind of applies more to us. I'm still working on it, but it's more of applies to us than it would, say, Midwest tornadoes. So I'm really going to be sharing that with you guys coming up. It's going to be something great, I think.
There you go. See, he's going to develop his own number like Forbes at the Weather Channel. It's not going to be called DEFCON. It's going to be called Kevin Law's Condition, you know.
Sure.
No, I agree. I mean, we are in Dixie Alley. Kevin is at the Weather Service in Birmingham, and our severe weather outbreaks are inherently different from the outbreaks they have in the plains often. And so having a specific Dixie Alley parameter would be a very good thing. This is great.
Kevin, there was one other interesting parameter that you looked at that was something that no one had really thought of, and that was the orientation of lines and line segments. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, that turned out to be really big. It was 93% correlated. So if a squall line is kind of standing up north-south, it tended to produce a lot more tornadoes than, say, one that was kind of leaned over, say, from southwest to northeast oriented. And it turns out the large-scale wind vectors blowing in the back of it needed to be 90 degrees. So, in other words, a lot of our flow around here is from west to east. We don't get a lot of northwest flow except for the summer. So when our flow, general flow pattern is from west to east, and it's lined up, the squall lines lined up north-south, that means that the winds are blowing in practically a normal or 90 degrees into the back of it. And that seemed to be a huge 93% correlated to an outbreak. So looking at that shear vector, and it's a 0 to 8 kilometer shear vector, how it's oriented to the squall line made a huge difference, especially in the warm season squall line. So I was really happy to see that. We haven't tested it out yet. We've only looked at it historically, but we looked at it a little bit today, and it seemed to be a lot, you know, the flow today was a little bit more parallel to the line, say, than it was 90 degrees. So we're going to keep looking at that, some of that stuff.
Kevin, you played a big role in the Weather Extreme video, our training here for our spotters several weeks ago. Talk about dual pole and how that's changing the game for you guys at the Weather Service.
Yeah, to be honest with you, we almost every tornado we've seen warned on, someone that, like today that we didn't have a warning on, we have seen those debris signatures almost every time. Didn't matter the distance from the radar. We were assuming that obviously the further away you are is going to be more difficult to see, but I've seen them all the way down in Lowndes County now, which is a good 60, 70 miles away from the radar. I've even seen them over in Randolph County, Alabama, from the Atlanta radar. So, and I'm talking about little tiny F-0s, you know, seeing a lot of debris being lofted up at way up in the air. We had an incident, a little tornado that spun up a couple weeks ago. I guess it was back in October. A little F-0 only knocked down three trees, but we were able to pick up scans of debris signatures from that, in, you know, just south of Bessemer there from our radar at Birmingham.
I saw a picture today, I think, that Ari tweeted out that showed a strong correlation coefficient signature on that storm. Have you seen that, Kevin?
Yeah, we saw it this morning. In fact, that I wasn't there yet. I didn't come in until about 6 a.m., but the guys who were there saw that and immediately knew what it was. I mean, it was almost, you could basically tell the Birmingham authorities where to go look. I mean, that's how good this thing is. And it's, you know, we've seen it without damage reports, going out and looked, and sure enough, there it was. So,
Kevin, let me ask you this. A lot of people that watch this and listen to the show are operational guys. And is there a way, is there anywhere on the web they can maybe see this session you did for us? I guess we record. That's right. John Brown recorded that. But, you know, I think for a lot of us, and I'm speaking for myself, dual pole training is important because we know a lot more now than we knew a year ago. Right. And what's the best way of getting trained on this stuff?
Well, it's a good question. The Warning Decision Training Branch has some stuff out there. It's a little bit scientific. I thought the videos you guys recorded there for the extreme was, you know, the stuff we did there was probably about as down to earth as you want. If you want the really hardcore science stuff, you could certainly go to that Warning Decision Training Branch. The guy Jim Ledoux and Jamie Betcher and those guys out there have really done a good job with some of that. And those, they're in touch with the engineers. You know, this technology has been around a long time. This is nothing new. So these guys have been working on it for a long time. It's just now to where, you know, it got affordable. And an interesting story behind that is, you know, they put in all these radars, right? And they knew one day they were going to be upgraded to dual pole. So they already had the technology in place at every single radar, where it would be just a simple, you know, 1 week upgrade, and that's what we're looking at now. So they knew even back in the early and mid 80s that they were going to be one day adjusting this thing for dual pole.
And again, we're going to put a link to Kevin's session at Storm Alert Extreme on weatherbrains.com. Brian, we will request that Mr. Peters take care of that. And speaking of Mr. Peters, since it's about an hour in.
I got one question for Kevin before we move on. Going back to talking about how you, the challenges between your slight risk days where you're thinking, oh, it's no big deal, let's put the rookies on the warn gen and, you know, on the radar and let them do it, and then wanting to have the sort of more experienced meteorologists on the big days, but then figuring out that you really need that experience on those marginal days. When do you get your rookies any experience? I get why you want to do that. It makes a lot of sense. But at that point, you know, how do you get the up and coming forecasters any experience on any of those days?
Well, we've tried a couple of things. You know, the workstations are pretty cramped. There's already enough screens to last forever. So we tried to kind of put the folks together in the same workstation, and then you run into people not having the same color scales, the same radar procedures and things. So now we're going to try something new. We're going to put workstations sort of side by side. They're in the same vicinity. And a good example was September 2nd, or it was around the Labor Day. I think it was the Sunday before Labor Day. I think our neighbors were issuing a lot of warnings, and we had a couple folks come in who, you know, were kind of newbies on the radar, and we looked back and looked at the signatures they were warning on. So in other words, we gained expertise by talking with each other, talking back and forth, and kind of looking at things, scan to scan. We looked at the environment together. We looked at all the important things together instead of leaving someone out there who may be a rookie on an island by themselves. It's just not a good idea. It never is, because the stress And, you know, you have the stress of not missing it. Now there's been added pressure about false alarms, and we know that's too high. Now you had that added pressure. And I think that stress is just too much for somebody who's just fresh out of school. We can't do that to somebody. It's hard enough for me to sit down and do it. I mean, I don't have a lot of experience, but mm-hmm. we've got guys who've been there for 30 years, and you know, they don't want to do it either. There's a lot of pressure behind it, and nobody takes these decisions lightly. I mean, I'm sure Brian could tell you.
Cool, all right, let's do this. Let's hit Professor Peters, and we're going to come back with some of the regular segments. We will do a quick weather roundup. We've got the picks of the week. We've got all kind of stuff coming up here as Weather Brains rolls along.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
We are into that time of year when snow cover can be a factor in forecasting temperatures. So just what kind of role does snow cover play when making a temperature forecast? As the rays from the sun hit the surface of the earth, much of that energy is absorbed by the surface. This in turn warms the air next to the earth's surface, causing the temperature to rise. But when you introduce snow onto the ground, some of the sun's energy will be reflected away by the snow, and some of it will be used to melt the snow. This means that there is less energy available to heat the earth's surface, so the temperature rises more slowly than would occur with no snow on the ground. Three types of latent heat can be absorbed from snow. These include melting, evaporation, and sublimation. During the day, in a manner similar to clouds, snow cover is a good reflector of shortwave radiation from the sun. This is especially true of fresh snow. At night, snow cover is a good emitter of long-wave radiation. Often, record low temperatures occur on a night with surface snow cover. The sublimational and long wave cooling from the snow cover makes low temperatures colder than they might otherwise be. During the day, evaporation and melting promote cooling, and together with the reflection of the sun's energy, keeps daytime temperatures cooler. So when snow cover is present, forecasters need to lower daytime temperatures versus a no snow cover situation. At night, snow on the ground readily gives off heat. This causes rapid cooling, meaning that the forecast of overnight temperatures needs to be lower than what you would expect if there was no snow cover. If you have a weather question, drop an email to question@weatherbrains.com.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Peters. Bill, you going to do a This Week in Weather History, or are we going to pass on that this week?
Yeah, we'll have to pass tonight. James, I'm a little constrained over here.
I'm about to say, yeah, you guys are doing some male bonding over there.
Hey, we have separate headphones. We're not sharing headphones. I brought a splitter.
Yeah, at least Bruce didn't bring us a splitter. We were gonna be real earbuds for us.
But since we got a second here, we typically do This Week in Weather History. Let's ask Bruce about Mississippi State, that event today with Charlie Wax. A lot of us that have been around Mississippi State for a long time. Love this guy. I mean, he is a Southern gentleman. He is everything you would want in a professor. He's patient. He's a good teacher. He loves people. He loves his students. And he's no telling how many great students he's turned out over the course of his great career that spanned over 30 years. So I think that, that gathering must have been pretty cool today over in Starkville. Bruce, must have been a fun day.
It really was. It was one of those things that if I hadn't have made it there, I would have been missing out on a true life experience. That it was actually in the John Grisham wing of the Mississippi State Library. He has a tremendous collection for John Grisham, the artist or the author. And they had the reception in the John Grisham room. And we had, I believe Rennie said, 168 people there.
All the way
from Dr. Wax's grandkids and son and daughter and wife to, his brother. And this is what was really cool. Dr. Wax's PhD professor from LSU, who is, I believe, probably in his 80s, came and spoke for the first 15 or 20 minutes about him when he was a graduate student. It was very touching because Dr. Wax was my mentor. And he credits me as the first weather graduate from Mississippi State University. I came there as a 16-year-old freshman in 1979, and I took his physical geography class, and then I took his introduction to atmospheric science or meteorology, Luchin and Tarbox, I think was the textbook. And then I took his climatology class twice. So I was out of weather classes. I had no more weather classes to take. That's all they offered were those three. And so I decided to take it the second time to get a better grade.
Just for the joke.
Well, yeah, they were good. He thought I probably needed to take it twice. He thought I didn't quite get it all the first time. So, but I did. I took three weather classes at Mississippi State from 79 to 82. And I was majoring in petroleum geology. I was going to work in the oil business. That was my destiny, I thought, at that time. And he changed my mind. Having a professor that was that personable and could speak right to you and not over you. And, you know, he changed my life. And I was a very young kid coming out of Jackson, Mississippi. And when I got an email from Mike Brown, Professor Brown, that this event was going to happen, I always wondered, why was he retiring on December 10th, 2012? I was wondering why. Today is his 66th birthday. So today is Dr. Wax's 66th birthday, and he had planned the whole time to retire, I guess, on this day. And, you know, after a 35-year career, he got there in 1977. He was hanging it up today, but he has, you know, been the state climatologist for the state of Mississippi for many decades, and was head of the geosciences department, I believe, for over a decade, and up until, I think, 2001. He just affected a lot of lives, and many of the people listening to us tonight have taken classes through Mississippi State, but they really invented, I believe, they kind of almost invented distance learning, you know, in the late 80s. He recognized the need for broadcast weather people, anchors, not meteorologists, but weather anchors, to get more education. And as we all know how competitive television and radio can be, people couldn't quit their jobs and go move to Starkville, Mississippi and go back to school. It's just too competitive. You may not get back into the industry. So he decided that he would come up with a program that would allow people that were already in place in TV markets to actually go back to school. And they started it with VHS tape, mailing out VHS tapes out. And I believe it went to CDs, and now it's all online. But I actually had already graduated from Metropolitan State College in 1986 before this actually really all got going. And I've never graduated from Mississippi State. I actually only went there for 3 years. I don't hold any degrees from the university, but he does give me some undue credit there, but I just had to be there. There's one of those things in life, you know, you get a feeling deep down inside that if you miss something, you'd be sorry, and if you'd be really sorry if you missed it. So,
like Weather Brains every week.
That's right. So yep. I was so proud to go. And there's something else I wanted to talk about, that they're looking to build a there was actually a director of development from the College of Arts and Sciences there, and they've raised about $14,000 now towards a chair in Dr. Wax's name for the geosciences department for broadcast meteorology. And they want to raise about $100,000. That will be a great starting point to chair a actual faculty position in the geosciences department. So I thought we would make a plea through the National Weather Association and even on Weather Brains tonight, that people that have been touched by, I call them disciples of Dr. Wax, and or his mentors or mentees like myself, you know, if you want to donate $50 or some money to this sometime, where down the road, doesn't have to be now, it can be in years from now, but it'd be a good cause. And they're also going to start a scholarship for a broadcast meteorology student that would hopefully be something that would go on for many, many decades, and give away a scholarship to a needy student that wants to come and study broadcast meteorology. So these are a couple of things they're working on. There's a gentleman named Alex McIntosh. He's the director of development for the College of Arts and Sciences. And we spoke, and we're going to probably write something up and maybe put it into the, hopefully in the National Weather Association newsletter, and just kind of get it out there, or get it out there any way we can. But I just think that'd be something to honor somebody who gave, you know, 35 years of his life teaching others. And as you know, he's touched so many people. And I did, you know, shout out your name in there, James. I said, you know, touched many people's lives, and I'm so happy to know that there are people out there like James Spann and like, you know, meteorologists. I can name a whole list of people. You know, we've got friends all over Huntsville, Memphis, Jackson, Mississippi, Birmingham, all. I call them disciples of Dr. Wax because they were all touched by that program, that distance learning program, or they actually were on campus and got their training through that. So it's
what he did, Bruce. You know, when he brought in Binkley, and he gave a lot of us the opportunity to do what we needed to do. I came from electrical engineering. I was a double E major and absolutely love weather. And like you say, I couldn't quit. I mean, I was married, I was young, married, and, you know, the career was rolling, and I just couldn't stop and go to school for 4 years. So, you know, through what Dr. Wax did and what Mark Binkley did, it gave me the chance to have a wonderful career. And, you know, hopefully I've been able to pass along that blessing to other young people that have come up under me. And here's a trivia question. Who do you think my proctor was, okay? Now, this is way back in, like, the late 80s or something. Okay, who do you think my proctor was when I took the exams? J.B. Elliott. The world's greatest weatherman. I'd come out there and take all those exams out there. So that was a hoot. So, but again, what we'll do, we'll get a link and put it up on weatherbrains.com. But I encourage everybody that has been touched in some way, shape, or form by Dr. Wax or the program at Mississippi State, go out there and, you know, give $50, $100. Some of you can afford to do a lot more than that. And that will really be something that would be a good thing. So, Brian, we'll get a link up on weatherbrains.com. We'll get that before we go here. So I tell you what, it's looking at the old clock on the wall here. We've got to move along here, and I know that we've got to. I mean, we've got to have a lot of email, and Nate has got it all for you.
Letters. We get letters. We get stacks and stacks of letters.
First off, a correction from your humbled email officer. A tweet from Gara. We read a listener survey from this person last week. I didn't know this. I didn't know. I apologize. We've made up on Twitter, but it's a girl. It's not a guy. So whoever does those, whoever built that form needs to add on a box, male or female, so that I know which sets of pronouns to use. Anyway, very sweet. I appreciate the tweet and the kind words. Thanks for listening. We did pronounce her name right, though, so that we got points for that. All right. Tyler Tatton calls himself an avid listener. Liar. Anyway, just wanted to say that it looked like that INSEP has changed to a new model interface, but is complaining that it now times out too often, and he's not particularly impressed with that. So no hatred for INSEP, just lack of performance from his perspective. I don't know what's going on. I haven't used that particular interface. I usually just deal in grib data, but if anybody knows anything about that, let us know.
Anything that has anything to do with the government that's wrong, we're going to blame it on Kevin and Brian, since there are two government officials here.
Thank you.
But Kevin's not government official. Or no, Kevin Laws. Kevin Sellis.
Kevin Sellis is not a government official, but Kevin Laws is.
We can't blame the guests, though. The guests get to break the rules.
That's true.
I'll put it in the complaint box tomorrow.
Yeah. So Tim Bryce, another government official, sent us a note. Won't help us Apple fanboys, but now some Android users, get this, can now take and submit barometric pressure readings from their phones. And there is one of these, and there's one of these sort of crowdsourcing projects that you can register your phone, and that will take all of the data and make supposedly crowdsourced data maps of barometric pressure. So pretty cool with that. Look forward to seeing what that looks like as more people get on board. I think it's sort of that search for extraterrestrial life at home kind of project that would run as a screensaver. Anyway, I got a new, got a link from Marcus Toops, blog from the American Geophysical Union about an electrifying new way to potentially predict tornado touchdowns. Pretty cool. Post a link to that on the old website there. Going back to last week, this is our last email, by the way, and I want to open a little bit of discussion in the time we have left. Matthew Romai sent us a note saying he's talking about wall-to-wall coverage. Enjoyed the conversation last week. Said, can you guys talk about the dot two and dot three channels and maybe pull back the curtain just a little? How prevalent are they in Birmingham and elsewhere? And are there plans to put them up on DirecTV or Dish? And I'll jump into this and say that there's a clause in the FCC code when the cable companies are allowed to operate that requires, it's called the must carry provision. And that essentially says to the cable company that barring the unforeseen, they're required to carry a local station, local affiliates on basic cable. And it's more complex than that, but that's sort of the gist of it. But that does not pertain, and there was a ruling about this a few years ago, that does not pertain to the .2, .3, .4 subchannels. Having said that, cable companies are more likely to carry them than the satellite companies because the cable companies have more... A lot of times they have more availability, more bandwidth, and with the switch digital video, they can, at times they can offer it, but only use bandwidth if somebody actually wants to watch it. And that's for some of the more advanced cable operators. I'm not sure, and James, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure that I know of any dot two or dot three channels for local affiliates that are on DirecTV or Dish in any markets. Maybe an exception in like New York or LA or something, but it seems like it's just the primary channels that are on.
Right. I don't think you're ever going to see the dot twos and the dot threes on DirecTV or Dish. I just don't believe that's going to happen. Of course, all this is negotiable. You know, the stations negotiate the rights fees, and it's kind of complicated, but I just don't think you're going to get it on satellite. So, but most cable systems do carry it. We here in our operation, we have a dot two and a dot three. The dot two, some of you are watching right now. This program is on our dot two, which is a 24-hour weather channel. The dot three carries the Nashville network. This was a former cable channel back in the 80s and 90s that has been reborn on these, you know, digital sub channels like this. And we carry that here. And also, too, Matthew, in response to your question, one important point, the dot twos and the dot threes are not high def. They are standard def. And accordingly, you know, when you watch them, they're not 16:9. They're 4:3. They're kind of old school, but then again, you know, they serve a great purpose. So, but in the problem that, you know, we have as broadcasters, you know, we've got to find a way to get this to those that are, you know, satellite subscribers. Like, for example, I'm a DirecTV guy, so I don't get the dot two or the dot three on, you know, on the satellites. So we make it available on the internet and hopefully soon, and maybe as early as next year with this new Apple TV hardware that is coming out, this will all be fixed where you can watch internet programming on your television with ease, just like a satellite or anything else. But I do think that we can use those dot twos during severe weather when it's not that bad. It doesn't warrant, you know, blowing off regular programming, but we can go on there and go on the live stream on the internet. So
that's, yeah, I know that was a challenge that and a lot of confusion or misunderstanding about that as we rolled out digital TV. And a lot of folks thought that, you know, this will solve all of the regular programming challenges because you'll just be able to dump your coverage over to dot two or dot three and go with it. The problem is that in theory, everybody in your viewing area should just be able to put up an antenna and pick up the dot two or dot three signals. Problem is, very few people do. I'm one of those geeks that I've got a digital antenna stuck in the house and I run cable, and so I can pick up all those extra channels, but very few people do. If you've got cable in our market, you get them, but neither of the satellite companies provide any of the those digital subchannels, and since they're not required to, and stations typically aren't going to fight to have them included, and the satellite companies, quite frankly, don't have the bandwidth to do that for everybody. I'm not sure that that's ever going to quite work out, at least the way we thought it would. What we've done here is instead of bumping the severe coverage to dot two, in a lot of cases, we'll bump regular programming to dot two. And that does rub satellite customers the wrong way. But that allows us to get the weather information out in the way we need to. And folks that just aren't affected or just don't care, the however many, you know, roughly somewhere between a half and two thirds of the viewers in our area that do have those access to those channels, you know, can at least see some regular programming. It's, as James said, it's not standard. It's not HD. It's going to be standard def, but it's something. And that actually has helped. We've been able to limit some of the complaints, and you're never going to get rid of all of them, but that's helped a little bit, and it may be an option in some markets as well.
Yep. And again, in noticing the time here, we're going to go in and do picks of the week. And if we have time, we'll come back and finish some of this other discussion. But this is where we go around the horn. Everybody shares their pick of the week. We don't have a fog bank this week. We almost forgot it last week, and hope Skydaver's not mad and because we almost forgot him. But Skydaver typically has the best picks, but he is traveling this week and will not be able to do a fog bank. So before I forget my pick, it is the video of the tornado in near Orlando today. Did you guys see that? That's been floating around this evening.
Yes.
Fascinating.
We can have tornadoes in December, and so they certainly had a few down there in a broad area between Orlando and Daytona Beach this evening. So it's a YouTube video, and then all these picks are up on weatherbrains.com. Producer JP, did I steal your pick?
You took it. It was a great pick. Yeah. But, you know, so you talk about Florida. You know, there was an event in February.
Whoops, did we lose producer JP's audio?
Oh, no.
Nope, hit the wrong button there. I was going to say,
it
reminded me of that event in February in the mid-90s. I forget which. I think it was 97. There was a tornado outbreak in central Florida, if you guys remember that. And I think a few people were killed. So occasionally, you do have tornadoes there. And, of course, during the blizzard of 93, outbreak down there as well. So you occasionally see severe weather down there. They're not immune to it.
Yep. All right. Well, let's go to the internationally beloved meteorologist. I love it. We got a WCM and we got a Sue on the show here. This is great. Brian, what's your pick this week?
I don't have one.
Oh, what? No. This foghorn button's going to blow up here.
I know it.
All right. Brian's so busy putting on his TV makeup, he doesn't have time to do a pick of the week.
Yes.
He's got to put on his powder and his CoverGirl pancake tan number two, get his hair coiffed up. You know, his weave's got to be put on right. So
I'm taking my pants off.
Whoa. Show title. Thanks.
That's the show title. If you didn't hear the start of the show, then just back it up and you'll see the trouble we got into. All right, Kevin Laws, we've rambled along enough here. Hopefully you got a pick for us this week.
Yes, every weather geek should have, every Sioux should have, twisterdata.com.
Yes. So what is twisterdata.com?
It's just a standard. Yeah, it's a standard model site. I think it has the RAP, the NAM, and the GFS. But the big thing I love about it is you can click on any point on there and get an immediate forecast sounding for that point. Love it. Love it. Love it.
Okay. Yeah, I have seen that. I didn't know it was called twisterdata.com. It's actually in my bookmarks. That is a great site. That's a great pick, and I don't think we've had it as the pick before. So that is a great one. And again, all of these links will be up on weatherbrains.com. Nate, what's your pick of this week?
Well, a WeatherBrains alum, Cliff Mass, out from Washington, has a blog post out today talking about how the Weather Service should be the preeminent, he used the word dominant, I love that, weather prediction agency in the world, but they're not. And it points out on a number of things where it points out some very specific things the Weather Service and NOAA and the federal government should do so that we can get that way. Talks about computing, but also some organizational challenges and whatnot. Really interesting, thought-provoking reading, and I enjoyed reading it.
We got to get Cliff back on the show. That guy's got big pipes,
and
man.
We need to get him on, you know, live. We were able to get him on recorded a little while back, but we need to have an actual live Q&A with him sometime.
Yeah, I like this guy, man. We got to get him back. Bill, that's one of your jobs, to get Cliff Mass back on the show on video. All right, so Bill Murray and Bruce, I'll let you guys do your picks together out there.
Bruce, go ahead.
No, I don't have one.
Give him the foghorn, James.
What? Okay, hold on.
That's three foghorns in one show. This is like a world record.
I would have
record.
Done a shameless plug for MidlandUSA.com or something.
Well, there you go. You're allowed to do that.
There you go. All right. There you go. Yeah, we defoghorn you.
James, my pick is Kevin's YouTube channel, which is NWS Kevin Laws, and you can find both the art and the science of polygonology there. Two excellent webinars that he did for media broadcasters in Central Alabama, and it contains more in-depth information about what we talked about tonight. And as someone said on Twitter, Kevin Laws is out there dropping southeastern weather gems on WeatherBrains. So we appreciate you being
here
tonight.
I said that.
Oh, that.
Hey,
was-
no more shameless plugs. Stop it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well. Yeah. That is a. Let me tell you what. That's riveting. And I am busy. And I have ADD problems. But when Jim Stefkovich sent me a link to that YouTube channel, I was glued. I mean, when you got my attention like that, it is good. And let me just say this. I'm not blowing sunshine here. I smoke up Kevin's skirt. But what he has done down there is this transformation process where I can't tell you how good the warnings are out of this local office, the efficiency, and they're on the right track. And Kevin, you've done a great job down there. Yeah, so just changed, don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. Okay.
I kind of buried the lead here because, you know, we talked at the beginning about the statistics from October of 07 through the year 2011. Remember, we said the POD was 76%. The Birmingham office in 2012 has achieved a POD of 92%. That's an increase, while the false alarm rate dropped from 80% to 40%. They cut it in half and maintained a lead time of 17.7 minutes, which was actually up 0.2 minutes over the previous time, 17.5. So, you know, that absolutely hijacks the theory that you know, you couldn't have your cake and eat it too. Kevin, y'all done it, and we appreciate it.
Well, but I don't know that it does hijack that theory. I think it's the exception that proves the rule. If you look at Harold Brooks's paper from, I think, 2004, where he talks about signal detection theory, the only way that you can improve both of those at the same time is with a substantive improvement in technology or in procedure. And I think what Kevin has done is he's made that improvement by doing the situational awareness work and looking at some of these side indices to understand what environments are more likely to produce tornadoes than others, understanding the psychology of, you know, rookie forecasters versus experienced forecasters. And I think taken as a whole, that does account for an adjustment in that one criteria that Brooks talks about, so that you can raise both of those criteria. And I think that's really fascinating and something I look forward to hitting the YouTube channel to learn more about.
Sure. Well, thank you guys. But listen, we haven't had the full spectrum of events. 2012 has been a slow year, so let's wait a little bit, see how it's going. But so far, all the credit has to go to our crew because they have, it's one thing to sit back and show people statistics and try to teach this stuff. It's another thing to embrace it and, you know, take it head on as a challenge. And I think that's what our forecasters have done. So that's really where it stands.
Great. Well, guys, I've got to ramp it up and go across the hall here and do a little bit of television. I love this time of the year because I get to play some really, really nice music. This is the guy that sings our theme song. His name is Mark Phillips. And as we bid you adieu, I'm going to play a little Christmas special.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Weather Brains is the weekly show all about weather. We typically do the show Monday nights at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern. We stream it live at live.bigbrainsmedia.com.
Come on, JP, help him out here.
Help me out, man. Help me. Throw me a bone. live.bigbrainsmedia.com.
You're doing fine.
Thank you.
We have an official show title. I took off my pants.
Oh, brother. this music is so good. I'm soothed. I'm getting mellow. I'm imagining myself by a crackling fire, the Christmas light. See, Kevin's got his Christmas tree back there. I mean, it looks good. But anyway, if you want to get in touch with us, Nate's, look at this. Nate's got a Christmas tree. Are you kidding me? Wow. Brian, have you got one?
Downstairs.
All right. Our address is, it's email at weather, email at weatherbrains.com. I'm all Christmased up here. And our Facebook accounts and Twitter accounts are up on the website as well. So on behalf of the entire Weather Brains crew, I'm James Spann. Thanks a lot for listening. Have a wonderful week. Merry Christmas. And God bless. Oh, man, this song is so good. Hey, Kevin and Bruce, thank y'all for staying up late. I know you guys have had a long day. Y'all are great. Thank y'all.
Hey, no problem.
Enjoy it. Thanks for having us. Yep. It's always a pleasure.
Good to see you, Bruce.
Nice to see you too, Nate.
Take care, Kevin.